welcome you cordially to my podcast Neumusik Leben. I have studied classical music and singing, but nowadays I really love singing lots of contemporary and experimental music. If you would like to know more about me, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. I will put this into the show notes. And you could also subscribe to my monthly newsletter there and find out everything about me. In this podcast, I talk about topics and themes all around new and contemporary music. I share with you the backgrounds, the behind the scenes, the insider knowledge, and I bring you the human beings out of this new music world much closer. I'm always very, very touched when you write me, give me feedback, and I also often hear how much and how inspirational my podcast is for you, and this is really touching me. It also keeps me motivated to keep going. Well, I'm cooperating with the NMZ, Neue Musikzeitung, which is such a great German newspaper or German, in the German language, because obviously you can also buy it in other countries or in Switzerland or in Austria. So this is one of the most important and biggest papers, magazines about music, in the German language. In today's podcast, I have an amazing guest. His name is Joel Sachs. And I'm so pleased and happy that I could meet him while I was in New York and that we had such a great encounter and how we talked about things and also the interview I'm gonna share with you in a, in a while. And I mean, he's such an amazing man, and when you look at his biography, you're just, amazed. He has founded the new Juilliard Ensemble. He has been with Juilliard for so many years until 2022, when he actually retired. He founded this new Juilliard Ensemble. He also produced the festival for new music called Focus, and it's so many great things there. And also, he is a pianist and a conductor, where he was really, or he is still, performing throughout the whole world. Even countries like Mongolia are on his list. And he's also a big expert on Charles Ives, and I think he will also tell in this interview very interesting aspects about Charles Ives. So check this man out, Joel Sachs, and enjoy the interview with him right now. Hello, Joel. Hello, Joel Sachs. I welcome you to my interview and in my podcast, Neue Musik Leben.
Hello, Irene, and it's a great pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, and I'm so excited to actually meet you in New York, in the real town, and then person, and that's
yes,
so,
and I can show you around a little bit.
Yes, you did. We had great coffee and tea and a cinnamon brioche, which was fantastic.
Absolutely, with a few ambulances as background music.
Yes, it was. At first, I would like to know, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
Well, that's actually a long story, I'm afraid. But when I was between the ages of 21 and 23, I was living in London studying piano and trying to be a virtuoso, becoming very aware of the various young virtuoso passing through who had won competitions and finding most of their playing rather tedious. And I wasn't quite sure why. I think part of it was that they had started their careers too quickly. They hadn't had a chance to mature, but they unfortunately could be compared with incredibly great performers like Arthur Rubinstein, who was very much still playing, and with conductors like Otto Klemperer and Pierre Monteux. It was just a very peculiar sense that I was trying to do the same things they were, but somehow I wasn't really sure that that's what I wanted to do. But I didn't actually realize it until later that the real problem was that their idea of making music was trying to be better than everybody else at doing the same thing everybody else was doing. And that was apparently not interesting me very much, although I didn't realize it at the time. But I had met at the Marlborough Summer Music Workshops a woman called Cheryl Stern, now Cheryl Seltzer, and we enjoyed playing four hands piano together and two piano music. And she fortunately had studied in college with a couple of really good people like Leon Kirchner, who was a superb composer and a superb pianist. And so she was already interested in playing new music. I'd had a teacher when I was a teenager who believed very much in playing new music. She was very well known and always put a new piece on every program. She used to say, if you don't play a new piece on every program, you cannot blame anyone but yourself if no new Beethoven arises, which made sense to me. Then the next thing that happened was kind of odd, which is that I was back at Columbia getting a doctorate, and I had a wonderful seminar about Robert Schumann and his circle, and the professor who was giving it knew it extremely well, and he could get you very excited about all the people that Schumann was friendly with. And one day, I remember I had just shaved and was getting ready to go off to school, and I thought, there's something really strange about this. Why am I living vicariously in the lives of people who've been dead for 150 years when I could be living in my own world? The next thing that happened was that I went back to Europe doing research on a 19th century composer, which was very exciting, very interesting stuff. And I had a note from Cheryl saying that she had become so angry that very early works of Webern that had been discovered, student pieces, were being played instead of his real music, that she and a friend of hers decided to put on a retrospective concert of Webern. And she later told me she'd spent all her wedding presents doing it. But people loved it, and they said, would you do more? So she said, when you come back from your research, we'll be doing another season. There'll be two concerts, one of Arnold Schoenberg and one of Stefan Volpe, whom I barely knew, but she'd already studied with him. And would you like to play? And at the end of that season, they said, would you like to help direct it? And so that really started me off in the, you might say, the non-academic world of new music. That was how it really began. But the other thing is that I had an instinct about this because when I came back to America in 63, I could have gone directly into the master's program at Harvard. I had been accepted and then given a grant to study abroad. But I was in the department. I thought, it feels very stodgy. And I thought, maybe I should go to Columbia. There's an electronic music center there. That was the only thing that I thought about, that I'd be studying historical musicology, but there might be something really exciting going on. And it turned out, of course, that living in New York was just beginning to get exciting. And so when what later was called Continuum was founded, it was also at Columbia. And later, what happened at Columbia was known in a famous discussion as uptown music in comparison with downtown music.
Really?
Yes. It was very strange. I wasn't at this, but there was apparently a seminar and a public seminar, and John Cage was one of the speakers. And somebody said, so John, what's the difference in your mind between uptown music and downtown music? Downtown meaning Greenwich Village, meaning the crazy stuff. Uptown meaning the serious academic modernism. And he said, I wish I'd been there to hear it, but he said, that doesn't sound very interesting. I'd rather talk about zip codes, you know, postcodes. And he proceeded to talk about zip codes.
Wow. So you went to Columbia and did the electronic music.
So I went to Columbia, but Continuum was different. We wanted to put on the whole spectrum of everything. So that's how it all started.
And now let's make a jump, because you had an amazing position. You were a professor at Juilliard until last year for many, many years, 52 years?
Well, what happened was that my first teaching job was at Columbia, and I had a colleague who was a medievalist, but a really fabulous breadth of interests, and he was giving a once-a-week music history lecture at Juilliard, And he told me that he was getting tired of it. He had other things to do. Did I want to share it with him? So he proposed it to Juilliard. So in 1970, the two of us would give these lectures. And at the end of that year, he decided he'd had enough. And I took it over. And gradually, we expanded it to two lectures on the Wednesday morning for undergraduates, so that there was a little more of a historical scope. But frankly, the president of Juilliard at that time was not that interested in that kind of thing. The next thing that happened was that I had to leave my job at Columbia because there was no tenure, but I got a job at the City University of New York, which was eliminated during the budget crisis in the 1980s. And so I found myself without any work just at the time when Peter Menon, the president of Juilliard, died suddenly. And for that interim year before the new president was found, I needed some more work, and I proposed to the dean that I start a workshop in the performance of new music, which Peter Menon would never have allowed. And he said, fine. And then Joseph Polisi became the president. And I remember we were standing outside Juilliard. I'd never met him before. On the opening day, he had created a proper opening day event. And he said, so what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm teaching music history. He said, what? He said, well, I know your name as a performer of new music. Why aren't you doing that? I said, well, Peter never would have allowed it. So he started giving me things to do, and including the first problem was this annual contemporary music festival, which occurred every January, and which had been totally trashed by the New York Times the previous year, partly because it included Elgar's Cello Concerto, which was hardly what you'd call contemporary music, Although it's a perfectly fine piece. And also that the performances didn't sound very good. And so Joseph asked to talk about it, and I said, well, one of my students last year came up to me after one of the music history lectures in January, and he said, I hear you know something about the music of Alfred Schnittke. And I said, well, actually, oddly enough, I probably know more about it than almost anybody in this country so far. Why do you ask? He said, well, we're playing a piece by Schnittke on the Contemporary Music Festival, and we don't know what to do with it. We wonder if you'd coach us. I said, sure. When's the performance? He said, tomorrow.
Oi.
I said, well, you waited a little, didn't you? He said, we were just given the music 2 days ago. Mm. And this is the way it was being run. So we decided this had to end. And first of all, it had to be voluntary. And as Joseph put it, if people see that other people are having fun doing this, they'll want to do it too. And second of all, it had to have some kind of a thematic content, because he was very eager that it teach while it was making music. And I said, well, we have a problem, because for next year, for this coming year, for January, we're now in late September, so it was very late already. Mm. I said, the concertos have already been named for the orchestra concerts, and they are the Prokofiev Symphonia Concertante and Quincy Porter, who was a teacher at Yale, his viola concerto, and they're not exactly what you call new. So he said, yeah, and we're stuck with it, aren't we? I said, yeah, because the kids have been practicing for competitive audition. So I said, you know what we could do? And here I was taking a chance, because I didn't know how he'd react. I said, let's say these two pieces were written about 1949. Let's say that we have a festival that explores the music of the first 10 years after World War II ended, and that it had a huge range, and if we went from Babbitt on one end to Cage on the other, these would fit in the middle. And he thought that was great. And the odd thing was that was a Friday, and we decided to reconvene on Monday and talk about it. And he gave me unlimited access to him, because he really wanted this to happen. We had both at the same time come up with the same title. He, while jogging up in Westchester, not far from where we were staying, actually, in Rye, and I, while shaving in Manhattan, we came up with the word focus.
Mm-hmm.
And it stuck. And it remained that way until my last year at Juilliard. So, and then we were doing our first, and what turned out to be our only, live from Lincoln Center Juilliard telecast. And he asked me to be on the organizing committee, which I was. At some point, he introduced me to someone who does everything but cook for the receptions.
Oh, and when did you start then the Juilliard New Music Ensemble, or did it already exist?
I'm sorry, say that again?
That the new music ensemble of Juilliard, did it already exist, or did you...
No, that's another story.
Started it.
Yeah, that's another interesting story in politics, actually. So I got to work on this telecast, and at the end he said, you know, you really should be full-time. You have two kids, you need insurance, and et cetera. So tell me what you want to do, and we'll make a contract. Couldn't ask for better.
That's amazing.
That was great. So that's how it started, and then... We went through a succession of deans, rectors, as they're usually called in German, and there were a couple who were really not that sympathetic with new music, but when one of them left and the new one came in, who actually was the director of the liberal arts program, he called me because we had been team teaching a seminar, and he said, that contemporary music ensemble we said we needed. Do you want to do it? I'm seeing Joseph tomorrow. I'll ask him. Absolutely. And the word came back, yes. Now, there had been a Juilliard ensemble at Juilliard in the 60s, founded by Luciano Berio, who was teaching there for a short time. Mm-hmm. Dennis Russell Davies, who's mm-hmm. conducting, you certainly must know, and a couple of other people. It was entirely unsponsored by the school, although... men and let them perform there. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of the players, he told me a story about how they went to Menon with the program that they were about to do and he ripped it up in their face. I think it was going to include Varese and Volpe and mm-hmm. who knows what. So I decided to call mine the new Juilliard Ensemble, a double meaning, the new ensemble and also the new Juilliard mm-hmm. that was doing this. And Joseph and I always had an agreement that I could program anything I wanted as long as he could hate anything he wanted.
And were the students then interested, or did you really hunt for them?
No, they were. It was really interesting. We put out notices that for the festival, it had a lot of volunteers, because the word got out quickly that you were actually going to have a really good audience for this. And the press, I mean, we, for the activities I did at Juilliard, I think I had 700 reviews over the years, mostly in the New York Times. I mean, the newspapers looked forward to this because it was different from anything else happening at any other time of year. And they basically assumed if Juilliard students were performing it, it's going to be good.
That's amazing.
So that was the thematic festival, but the new Juilliard ensemble was going to be different. I wanted to play very up-to-date music, and I wanted it to be as unthematic and unbiased in any direction as you could get. And so I set off with what became celebrated, which was music from all over the planet. Mm. We commissioned an Indonesian opera.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I can tell you more about that. All sorts of people wrote for it. We had hundreds of U.S. premieres and a lot of world premieres.
I'm really excited to hear that, because I know that in German universities, even nowadays, they still have a hard time to get musicians interested in the new music ensemble. And when I was studying at SMU in Dallas, Texas, I was the only singer who did that, and everybody else thought I'm a little crazy.
Yeah.
But so it's exceptional.
Juilliard, and well, I'll tell you what, one change that I recently was updated on just last week by a musician who had been at the Royal Academy of Music. Back in around 2004, I've forgotten the exact year, Simon Bainbridge, who was a composer teaching at the Royal Academy, whom I knew and had played his music, he proposed to me that we put together a joint project and see if we could get it funded. Namely, that we'd create an ensemble of, we said, let's say 10 players, half from Juilliard, half from the Academy, and the program would be consisted of one kind of focal work, which we decided would be the Webern Concerto for 9 players, so one player wouldn't be able to take part in that. And then there would be 3 pieces by Juilliard composition students and 3 by Academy composition students. They came over, we did it in New York, rehearsed it in New York, did it at Juilliard. Then we went back to London and recorded it there and then played it at the Academy. But at that time, the violinist of the ensemble, who's now a very big figure in London music, Thomas Gould, said to me, you know, we're kind of lucky because for this we have really good Academy players, but sometimes, because they're all compelled to take part, in the so-called Manson Ensemble, you get someone who really hates him and really poisons the atmosphere. It was a fantastic group. So that was why I said to Joseph, it's got to be voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
And they did volunteer. We had amazing players, many of whom have huge careers now. Eric Huebner, who's pianist of the New York Philharmonic. Olivia Stanton, who at 21 became second flute of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And they would play anything, you know. And they loved it. After I retired, I got all kinds of letters from people saying that was such an incredible experience to play that kind of music.
That's so amazing to hear, because I thought you might have had more struggles in the beginning, but obviously it was the right thing at the right time.
I'll tell you what happened on the first festival. You may have heard of these people. Andreas Heflecker?
Mm.
You don't know him?
Mm.
Have you run into his brother Michael, who runs the Lucerne Festival?
I heard about him, yeah.
Yeah, well, Andreas is a fabulous pianist, and he's married to Marina Piccinini, who is a flutist of extraordinary talent. And as I announced this first Focus Festival, I was giving, what I'd been allowed to give was a seminar on the performance of new music in that 1 year before Joseph took over, which we continued. And in those days, there was so little other offering that they'd be a very big group. So Marina and Andres, who I don't think were married yet, but were going together, they said, we have a piece we wonder if you'd be interested to have on the festival. It's in the time period. I said, what's that? She said, the Boulez Sonatine. I said, are you kidding? That's so hard. Do you have time? She said, oh, we already play it. Can we play it for you? So I said, sure. So they came over to my old apartment and played it, and I couldn't believe my ears that they were students still. It was totally fantastic. So, yeah. Now, what happened later was that a student had the idea of forming another ensemble that would be run by students, which I thought was a good idea, give them the experience. But after a year, she graduated, and nobody wanted to take it over, so it became another sort of official ensemble. And the idea was they would do older classics and we would do newer ones. But then the strain on the number of available musicians began to get a little tough, and it was hard. We'd occasionally have to hire in an alum to fill in a place. Mm-hmm. But the enthusiasm was there. It's just there were too many outlets for it.
And would you say this is just Juilliard, or is the general a big interest in contemporary music in New York, and that the people are much more open? And because we have prejudice against new music also in Germany, and I know that like Metropolitan Opera also does very nice but also conventional productions, but
the Metropolitan Opera,
yes, but
well,
but I mean,
I've got a surprise for you. They're doing 4 new operas this year.
I'm going into Dead Man Walking on Sunday.
Oh yeah, did you see the article in today's paper?
No.
It's been done at Sing Sing Prison outside New York City.
Oh, I read that too.
That's
amazing. Yeah, that's really amazing. I'm so excited, but I'm still so like, what's going on here? Because well, I always know that people had to struggle so hard for new music, and also in Dallas, Texas. I mean, there was one new music ensemble, a professional. They also coached us then. And they were like, in the first, whatever, 10 years of their season, there were like 4 people in the audience. And
yes, well, it's different here. I mean,
obviously,
New York is different. And first of all, it's so much larger. But when we started what became Continuum, there were 3 new music groups in, I think, the whole country, and all based in New York. There was Charles Morenin's Group for Contemporary Music, Arthur Weisberg's ensemble, the name of which I forgot now, and us. That meant it was reasonably easy to raise money because there were foundations that were supporting us. By 10 years later, they were mushrooming, and it became harder and harder to raise money because there were so many people after it. I don't know how many new music groups there are in New York, but there are a lot. The Metropolitan Opera is a very interesting story. Peter Gelb, the general manager, figured out that the operas that were doing well were of 2 types, either the eternal blockbusters like their Zeffirelli production of Bohème, which is amazing and has to be seen, and new operas. And so he's been commissioning operas, several by black composers, which are very interesting. The story of this opera, Dead Man Walking, is, you know it, I take it.
Serious. Very serious. And
yeah. And it's straight out of black culture.
Yeah.
There was another one by a composer, Blanton, I think is the right name, who's partly out of classical music and partly out of the Chicago improvised jazz rock scene, Fire in My Bones, which was very good, and he commissioned another, and he's bringing that one back. Mm. What Gelb found was that he got younger audiences with the newer operas.
I'm amazed and amazed and amazed.
Well, I'll tell you why it's important.
But this doesn't happen in Germany or in Europe.
I know. Well, but there's a lot of new stuff in Germany. There is a lot.
We have, but I mean, we also have the problem with, you know, audiences getting older and who's coming now. And
well,
obviously,
I'll tell you, do you know the Jahrhunderthalle in Bochum?
Mm-hmm.
So when I went to Cologne about 6-7 years ago, my friend said, there's going to be an Ives concert in Bochum. Did you happen to go to that?
Mm-hmm.
It admittedly had an American conductor, Stephen Sloan, who's the head of the Bochum Symphony, who happens to be the sister, the brother-in-law of the woman who was Dennis Russell Davies' big producer at Bonn.
Mm-hmm.
And Dennis has always been interested in new music. He invited us a lot. And so my friend said, I better get tickets right away because it's selling out. They did, I think, 6 performances of an all Ives concert in that gigantic old gas factory. It was unreal. Or have you ever seen on YouTube, from Bochum also, the production of Schoenberg's Moses und Aaron?
Mm-mm.
Now, my friend Jan, the opera director from Silver Moon, said he'd seen it a number of times at the Met. He never really thought it was an opera. It seemed more like an oratorio. This was done like an opera. The chorus had memorized its parts and was sitting among the audience.
Mm.
And the audience, I would guess, must be 2,000. And it was sold out for every performance. The singers were incredible. They used the hall very beautifully. It's got wonderful technical possibilities. It was amazing. So certainly Germany's got a lot going on, but it's not all over the place. New York always has a lot going on. The trick is to find out about it. Because advertising in the New York Times is now too expensive. And so people develop their own mailing lists. But even at Juilliard, I don't know what the new administration is going to be doing. They eliminated the new Juilliard Ensemble and the Focus Festival. But the new dean has his ideas of what he wants to do and perfectly entitled to do that.
Mm. Yeah, you experience a lot being here for such a long time and with Juilliard. And I mean, you also play the piano. You still play the piano. How do you handle all of that? Or how did you handle it? I mean, being a professor, teaching, educating, curating, playing the piano. Are you a very structured person or very disciplined? Or you don't sleep? I don't know.
Well, no. I think it's a mixture of two things. One is I am pretty structured. I mean, you have to be or you can't get along. But the other is that I learned a very important lesson from a very ancient composer. And that was the Austrian composer Johann Nepomuk Hummel. Do you know of him at all?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You wrote a book about him, right?
I did my dissertation about him. And he said in his big method of teaching the piano, he said, never practice more than 2 hours. If you do, you won't learn anything and you'll probably hurt yourself. So once you realize the trick is to practice very concentratedly, you can find time to do it. But I'm doing much more playing now than before I retired because I didn't have that much time.
Mm-hmm.
I would go to London for 4.5 days because I didn't want to miss classes. Now I can travel more extensively, and so I'm doing a whole bunch of recitals and conducting a concert and learning new repertory. I figure that's better than rotting in my head.
So you're very structured. And is there anything else you do to keep yourself healthy? I mean, you're still very freshly.
Well, I walk a lot.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Paris in May, I walked 11 miles every day,
mm.
just walking around, always figuring it's more fun to see the city than be under it. I do some exercises here and walking. And I used to swim a lot, but my pool closed, and now it's just not convenient anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, I do my best. I'd rather grow old in good condition than in bad condition. And you know, retirement can be very very destructive to some people. I think it was bad for my brother.
Mm.
and I certainly didn't want to.
But I also realized, I mean, especially actually in the pandemic, that like musicians or people who are freelancing in some way, they're so used to structure their time. So when like the pandemic came, most of them could handle it and had an idea what to do. But I heard, I also have friends who have like office jobs, and they were going crazy the whatever the first few weeks and month, because like, I don't know what to do. Nobody's telling me what to do. And I have so much free time now. Yeah. What am I going to do? And I think for us, it's like, there's always something we can do. And we're so used to, okay, no, I'll practice whatever 2 hours. I do this and that.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think that what one has to do is set up projects for oneself. I just had one canceled last night, unfortunately, which I was really looking forward to. Yeah. There's a very good orchestra, a non-professional orchestra outside of London in a town called Horsham, with whom I played Brahms' second piano concerto a few years ago, having learned it at the age of 78 or something. And we're going to do Bartók 3 this coming year. And he just let me know that he doesn't have enough money, so he can't rent pianos or use large spaces. But he said, we're not canceling, we're postponing it. But that was too bad, because Bartók 3, I thought, was a nice project for the age of 83.
Yes, it is.
I'll find others.
Yeah. And I might mention at this point right now that I'm very thankful that the composer Robert H.P. Platz kind of got us together, and you also played his music at Juilliard.
Yeah.
Do you want to say something about Robert or how you met him? Or?
He's just a very gifted composer, and I wish I'd had more opportunities to do more of his music. He's also a really nice fellow. And he, I don't know why, he also recommended me for something else that I can't do. Did he tell you the other thing?
No.
Oh, well, he mentioned to someone he knows that I was going to be in Germany in November.
Yes, you're in Leipzig.
Yes.
Playing Ives? No? Ives?
Playing Ives.
Ives, yeah. Yes, Charles Ives.
But this person wanted me to play at the annual presentation of the Beethoven Award, which is going to Gidon Kremer, apparently.
Ooh.
But it was too early. I couldn't go. And I thought he'd probably want me to play some Beethoven. Maybe I could voice off some Homelanum or something. But apparently what Robert got him excited with was that I was playing Ives.
Cool.
Which surprised me, but I'm delighted. So I'm hoping we can work it out for another year.
Yes, I wish it for you. And how did you become so interested in Charles Ives?
How did I become interested in Charles Ives?
Yes.
That's a very good question. I guess he's better known in this country, so I sort of knew about him. What I didn't know is that for 10 years, between the age of 5 and 15, I went to a summer camp in Connecticut, and he was still alive. He was only living 2 miles away. And what struck me as very sad when I learned about it was that my piano teacher at that time was very devoted to including new music in her concerts. She'd never heard of him. Nobody knew about him.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, I was from New Haven, and he had gone to Yale, and, you know, he's from Connecticut, so eventually you develop that kind of patriotic feeling about New England. But when I started getting to know it, I was totally astounded. So Continuum made a big CD of his music, some of the weirder stuff that we could find. And then I would do it when I could. I did a whole Ives Festival at Juilliard for the 50th anniversary of his death. And what I could not get myself to say publicly without losing it was that there was virtually nothing on that program that he ever heard performed, because no one wanted to bother.
Yeah, also, when I think I heard about him basically when I was studying at SMU, and we had a teacher.
Did you say music history course?
It probably was a music history course, but the teacher, how she introduced him was so interesting, because she said, well, this is a composer who my back then boyfriend of the professor knew too, but he was studying economics, because Ives like made a lot of money selling insurance.
Yeah.
And that was the bridge that her boyfriend also knew him because of economics, and she knew him because of music. And so he could publish his scores because he had the money, but I didn't know that there was so little really performed, and that's actually... Well, so sad.
Yeah, it's really tragic. The problem was, I've started out as a church organist and had very good jobs, but as he put it, I realized that I don't write the kind of music that is conducive to quiet meditation. So he thought he should do something else. And insurance attracted him because he was a real people person. And he did prosper partly because he had not innovative ideas about how to train people to sell insurance. But he used his money often to help other composers. Mm. And it was a boyfriend-girlfriend story, husband-wife story, actually, that got things started. So Henry Cowell, who was from California, I mean, it's a very long story that I can't get into now, but it's a very interesting story about how he became dedicated to helping other composers. I mean, the short story was that he had been going out with a young woman who was very rich and had helped subsidize the publication of some of his music, and then she was killed and left him some money. She was killed in a car crash. And he felt, according to his later wife, that he had been very lucky to have her, and he wanted to do something for them. So he started a magazine called New Music Quarterly, which he planned to finance by selling it on subscription, but, you know, it was never possible. And each issue consisted only of one or two compositions. At first, he wouldn't even allow a biography, just music, of composers who couldn't get commercial publishers to touch them. So one day in 25, I think it was, there was a woman called Margaret Nikolaric, who was a pianist married to a Serbian businessman, lawyer, I think he was, living in New York. And one day, her husband said, tomorrow night we're going to have dinner with an insurance man who's a colleague of mine called Charles Ives. And when, over dinner, she found out he was a composer, she said, oh, you should meet my friend Henry Cowell. He's doing this project. And I said, well, tell him to send me information and get in touch when he comes to New York. And Ives apparently was so wealthy that he was one of the first people to have a private telephone. So Cowell sent him it, and he was very interested. He offered to subsidize it. And Cowell said, then I insist on being allowed to publish some of your music. Mm-hmm. And Ives said, okay, but when you publish my music, I pay for the whole cost of that issue. I don't want it coming out of your budget. And so he published several very important collections of songs, mm-hmm. and the second movement of the score of the Fourth Symphony, which is about this high, which they were able to have engraved in Germany, where the currency was in such terrible shape that you could get something like that done for not too much money. Mm-hmm. Ives and Cowell started a recording series, and on the first recording was a piece by Ruth Crawford Singer, the slow movement of her unbelievably great string quartet. So there was this very, very strong cooperation, and Cowell did everything he could. Ives, unfortunately, lost a lot of money when the stock market crashed, so he could no longer help out the way he did, but he helped out some. And then what really got it going was that John Kirkpatrick, who was a pianist who later taught at Yale, had heard about Ives' famous monumental sonata called the Concord Sonata, mm-hmm. which is a kind of portrait of... Do you know it at all? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so four Concord philosophers. And he started playing it, and people began waking up. Then Lou Harrison conducted the world premiere of the Third Symphony. Ives wouldn't even go. He was afraid he'd be laughed at. Mm. But he got the Pulitzer Prize. So just as he was about at the end of his life, people were beginning to understand it. Now there's Charles Ives Society. I'm on the board, which is producing the, as far as possible, critical editions of his music because it goes off copyright next year. Oh. And then any idiot can put out an edition. Mm-hmm. And that's all being published by Pierce Southern. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in the United States, he's well known. But, I mean, there was a very funny story about my friend Catherine, whom you saw arriving in Corfu this morning. So she and her husband were both singers, ensemble singers. Have you ever heard the recording of Arvo Pärt's Passion? Mm-mm. Well, this is a solo vocal quartet that's featured in She's the Alto. Mm. So they did a lot of that before they went into their own individual professions. And she's a very good musician. He is too, but she's more involved. So last summer, she asked me if I would like to come down to the house and meet her children, whom I'd met on Zoom for the whole period of the pandemic, and her husband and her parents, and play the sonata, the Ives sonata for them, because nobody had ever heard it. And so I played the sonata, and, well, her parents were a little mystified by it, but that's okay, they're in their 80s. Catherine just adored it. And Alex, her husband, said, I've never known anything about Ives. And Catherine said, that's because he went to Cambridge, not Oxford.
And I mean, you already mentioned so many great people, and I'm sure in New York you meet so many great people. So who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you, or what inspires you?
I think in some ways Cheryl Seltzer, my continuum partner, her background on the West Coast was in many ways more advanced than the background of a lot of people on the East Coast, because at Mills was Leon Kirchner and people that she studied with in Washington State. But I think it's been her spirit of always exploring that has been very important. I think the encouragement of Joseph Polizzi was absolutely critical to my whole ability to try to do something with students and new music. As far as composers go, there are a few I've been very devoted to. Some of them you'll never have heard of, but I think they're great composers. Roberto Sierra, the Puerto Rican composer. Paul Desen, the late Venezuelan composer who never got a proper deal in life. Mario Davidovsky, who was one of the founders of the electronic music studio at Columbia, was a great composer. Valentin Bibik, a Ukrainian composer who I think should be much better known. I mean, this is when you feel you really want to have something done. Did I tell you I'd tell you about the Indonesian opera?
You wanted to tell me something about the Indonesian opera.
Would you like to know about the Indonesian
opera? Okay, let's talk about the Indonesian opera.
Yeah, because it's quite a story. I was standing in front of Juilliard one day, and a man walked up to me, and he noticed me just... I was having a cup of coffee and saying hi to people going in. He said, do you know the people here? He said, yeah. I said, yeah. He said, do you know the composers? I said, sure. He said, well, I want to commission an opera, but the fundraising people told me they can't deal with it. And I smelled an interesting idea. So I said, well, what are you after? He said, well, I want to write an opera for my girlfriend. And this man was about 70. He was an American living in Canada, obviously very rich. And he said, but I guess $20,000 won't get me much of an opera. I said, well, no, I mean, that's a big project. But I said, you know, if you thought in terms of a chamber opera, like a 15 players, three singers, I said, I did one last summer by a wonderful American composer, Jack Beeson, you probably never heard of, who was one of the most wonderful writers for voices in English that you've ever seen. That was three singers, 15 players. If you get a young composer and young librettist, they'd really be interested in it. So he took out a piece of paper and just scribbled on it, I will give Joel Saxon to Juilliard Ensemble $20,000 to commission an opera. I said, well, wait, I have to talk to them inside. He said, fine. So he gave me his fax number. He said, let me know what they say. So I went up to fundraising, and they said, well, we can't handle a commission. I mean, we just raise money for the school. I said, well, ask Joseph, if I take charge of it, can we accept it? And they came back and said, he said, fine, just have Joel take charge of it. And then on another occasion, he said, don't let him force off some mystical Canadian poet that we really wouldn't like. I said, don't worry. So I wrote the guy a fax and heard nothing. And then he came to town over Christmas and got in touch. And he said, let's talk about it. He mentioned some Canadian poet. I said, I made up a total lie. I said, you know, if you have anything to do with it, you might lose your tax deduction. Which is totally not true, but it got him off my back. So the question was who, and I wanted it to be unusual, but I also wanted it to be good for the voice, keeping in mind young singers, and was sort of puzzling about what to do. A concert came up that was going to have a new piece by the Indonesian composer Tony Prabowo, by whom I had done a piece for voice and ensemble about a year earlier. And he called me and he said, could you possibly make a copy of the tape of that? I meant to bring it from Jakarta, but I want to show it to somebody. I said, sure. So I'm doing my exercises on the floor of the dining room listening to this, and I thought, Tony's the man. Mm-hmm. He writes beautifully for the voice, and it's really unusual. In fact, Mario Davidovsky described the new piece that I did shortly thereafter as Berg with a gamelan. So I got in touch with Tony the next day, and I said, I've got the tape, but I have a question for you. Would you be interested in writing a chamber opera? He said, for the new Juilliard ensemble? I said, yeah. He said, I'll do it. Hadn't even mentioned money. And I said, do you think that Gunawan Mohammed, who had written the words for the other piece, might be interested? He said, I'll phone him tonight. And I said, tell him there's 10,000 in it for each of you. He got back and said, fine. Now, Gunawan's story was complicated because he actually was quite wealthy, which I didn't know, but he was the founder and editor of a kind of Newsweek magazine for Southeast Asia called Tempo, and the Suharto dictatorship had closed it. So he had time on his hands. So the whole project got started. First thing that happens, we had a date in mind, and then Tony was sitting in front of the Jakarta Arts Center with his long, scraggly hair, and some soldiers went through and beat him up because they thought he was a rebel. So he had to recover from that. Then Suharto was overthrown, and Gunawan's magazine was back in business, and he hardly had any time. But we finally got it done, and we premiered it at Alice Tully Hall in concert form. And the guy who commissioned it came to the rehearsal, and I didn't know if he'd like it or not, you know. But he was happy, and then he got loose in the building and commissioned a ballet.
When was that?
Oh, this was about 15 years ago, more or less.
I would like to hear it.
but the story didn't end there, because Tony had introduced me to a couple of glamorously beautiful Indonesian dancers who were in town. And one of them I'd become a little friendly with. In fact, she married and still lives here, although I haven't seen her in years. And she called me afterwards. She said, what did you think of the opera? I said, well, you know, it's funny. It didn't really feel like an opera. It was more like a cantata or something. She said, what would you think of it with dance? I said, I thought of that. Yeah, I think it would be great. She said, let's try to do it in Jakarta. Well, before I knew it, I got a call from Jakarta that had nothing to do with her. Tony had had the same idea, maybe from her. And he got the forces moving.
So you took the Juilliard Ensemble to Jakarta?
Well, we couldn't, because the bombings in Bali had just taken place. And Joseph said, there's no way we can let students go to a place that's just been bombed. Even if it's in Jakarta and not in Bali, there's a travel advisory on Indonesia. So I said, well, what about Continuum? And Tony said, great. So they paid to bring all the singers and the 21 of us to Jakarta. They had gotten the dancers and choreographed it. The scenery was built. There was a whole choral section added that Tony didn't bother to tell me about, with a superb chorus with the old Dutch name of the Batavia Chamber Choir, I think they were called. And it was stupendous. The one sad thing was that the alto who had sung in the New York performance, a Japanese gal of the most gorgeous voice and intelligence and everything, had died at 33 of cancer. So we had to restaff that. But it was quite an experience. And then we gave also a concert of a mixture of American music and some other works by Tony. And I wondered, who's paying for all of this? Well, at the final dinner, I was sitting next to a fellow who turned out to be the man who paid for it, an oil billionaire, who said he actually preferred Stephen Sondheim, something sweet.
Well, yeah.
So that was the story of the Indonesian opera.
And now, since you can look back at so many things, I have the question, what does success mean for you?
Well, a couple of things. One thing that was very possible always with the new Juilliard Ensemble was adequate rehearsal time. So that meant we were able to perform pieces that were new, brand new, on a level that many professional groups can't afford. Many of them are very quick and can learn quickly, but we'd have enough rehearsals so that the composer would say, it's just what I wanted. So that's one side of it, too. Second of all, success meant letting the New York audience hear music that they never would have dreamed had existed from Uzbekistan, from Kazakhstan, from Indonesia. Unfortunately, I did do a program of music that was part black and part white from South Africa, but the cultures aren't developed enough there. I think it's soon getting to the point where it will be more possible to get more Indonesian and Indian and Turkish and Pakistani composers, but even from them. So that was another. And then the other is that, as you see, we built it up so that young musicians at Juilliard wanted to take part in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did.
Yes.
And now they're out doing their own things.
Yeah. And for you in particular, is there anything that drives you forward, or did it just all happen by interesting coincidence? Or
it started by interesting coincidence, but no, I became really determined
mm-hmm.
to open up the eyes of people as far as I could find music that I considered to be music that I could recommend to the students with full enthusiasm, even though they might not all like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was really, really great.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not just reaching out in or through Juilliard. I mean, you're performing also throughout the world.
Well, yes, through much of that time, Continuum was performing, and we were all over. I mean, we went to Uzbekistan 4 times,
mm-hmm.
Mongolia 8 times. I went back 1 other time to conduct the Mongolian State Philharmonic. Yeah. My companion once said to me as we were leaving our hotel in Paris, "I can't go anywhere with you in the world where you don't know somebody." We walked into Metro Bastille and ran into someone I knew. That's a really nice
feeling. The impression I get too. You know so many people, or you know everybody, also in Germany.
Well, it's fun. I mean,
we could keep on talking. We might do afterwards anyway, but we arrived at the last question. And I would like to know from you, which tip would you like to give young artists?
Which tips for young artists? Be brave. Don't let anybody tell you that you can't do something. I recently played that first Ives sonata, which is a really big job for the audience, in London to an audience most of which had never even heard of Ives. They loved it. They loved the piece. Bring that to people. Remember, as my piano teacher said, if people don't play new music, there's no chance that a new Beethoven will arise. And the other is, have a way to support yourself if you need to, so that you're not dependent upon doing the same old thing over and over again, because that's a useless cause. There are very few people who can do that and who can make it work.
Well, I thank you so much for taking your time with me and talking to me.
Thank you for inviting me.
And
you're a very good
right
hostess.
Right in New York. Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So, well, bye, Rene.
Bye-bye.
This was the interview from today. I hope that it inspired you. And please send me your emails, send me your feedback, because I love to interact with you. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really, really hope that you liked it. And please tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. I thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.